Mrs. Griffiths, reel one. Whereabouts were you born, please?
I was born in a little village called Bow, near Okehampton in Devon, in 1921, February.
Can you tell me a little about what your father did for a living, which you were mentioning to me earlier off the record?
My father, before 1914, had been working at Treasury. He was an old contemptible. He was gassed on the, I think it was the 25th of September 1915, at a little village called Suchet. He was then in St. Thomas's Hospital for several months, and when he came out, he was told he'd never work again. But while they were sorting out his pension, he did an emergency temporary job back at the Treasury. He only worked, I think, until 1917, and after that, he was an invalid.
I think we should perhaps also mention that the family had some connection with Brook Drive, which is
at the back of our museum. Oh, would you like to? Yes,
museum.
He was born in 1879. It was called then Brook Street. I have his birth certificate. Which is the first house on the right of the Imperial War Museum.
Did you go to school in Devon?
I went to the... I didn't go to school at all until I was nine because I was a premature baby and I only weighed 3.5 pounds, which was disastrous in those days. However, I survived and I went to the village school in Bow when I won a scholarship because we were very hard up. My father only had a very small pension. And there was no other way I'd get to a secondary school. I won a scholarship and went to Crediton High School, where I remained until 1939 with a view to teaching, but the last thing I wanted to do was teach. So when war broke out, I sort of struck my breast and said, I must join up, but I didn't.
What was your reaction when you heard the news that we were at war with Germany?
Rather excited, I'm afraid.
Excited rather than fearful?
Yes, I've been brought up on stories of gas and war and Bruce Bairnsfeather cartoons. But, you know, when you're young, you're invulnerable. It wasn't going to happen to me. And it seemed as though life might change. Life in Crediton was rather dull for an 18-year-old.
Did you have any political attitude towards the outbreak of war?
Not really. I remember thinking, I wouldn't like to live under a Nazi rule. We'd had two German girls in our school certificate year at school, and I think they'd been sent over by their families to get away from Hitler and Hitler's ideas. And they rather made us feel that we wouldn't like a German rule, but on the other hand, nothing seemed very real. I was, after all, young. I remembered the depression of the end of the 20s. I knew that life went on, and I can remember the day war broke out. Actually, I was then helping with evacuees. I can remember going and sitting up in the fields above our house and thinking, well, whatever happens, this will still be here. There'll still be the fields and the sky and that, and life will go on.
How did these German girls make you feel that you wouldn't like German rule?
One had Jewish blood. She was called Ursula Gasparri, an unusual name for a German. And apparently they had been, to some extent, persecuted, her family. Not badly, but they're apprehensive, and that was why she'd come to England. I don't know what happened to her after school. And the other one, Inge-Lena Rice, was very keen on Hitler youth, and everything was Hitler was marvellous, which rather turned us against Hitler.
So you said that you wanted to join up. What exactly did you do?
I had been accepted for Bedford Teachers Training College, and I had an Devon Major scholarship, which meant that I'd have to pay back my scholarship if I didn't teach after my training. I didn't want to teach. My parents wanted me to. So I saw the way out, and I rushed off and volunteered for the Wrens. But they didn't know a good thing when they saw it. And they weren't geared up to taking endless girls, so they told me to go home and don't ring us, we'll ring you. So I went home and nothing happened, and finally I went into the ATS.
What happened once you joined the ATS?
I left home on the 18th of December 1942, travelled to Wrexham, where I went into training camp. Usual army training. That was the Royal Welsh Fusiliers camp. We stayed there until the end of the following January, I think it was, when I went to a holding unit, and we had all sorts of tests. And we had a psychologist who came and interviewed us, and I rather wanted to go into the Army School of Research, mainly because it sounded nice. And she thought that my arithmetic wasn't good enough, which it certainly wasn't. But she said there was a marvellous job, very hush-hush, very important, and just the sort of thing for me, and I was very flattered, so I said, OK, I'll do it, not knowing what it was, and it turned out to be wire signals.
Just going back to the training you had in Wrexham, you say it was the usual kind of thing, but how were you treated?
Do you want the whole story?
Please, if possible.
Well, we arrived around 10 at tonight, having left Devon around 10 in the morning, at Wrexham station. There'd been a bomb on the line and the train was delayed. We were bellowed out of the carriages by a rather hoarse-voiced, fat little sergeant who told us to line up. Whole lot of girls in civvy clothes, we didn't know what line-up meant, so we bunched together, got shouted at, piled into a truck, taken up to the Royal Welsh Fusiliers camp, where the first day it was nearly midnight by then, and we were given a meal, which we learned afterwards was called brown stew. It seemed to be grit mixed with snails, as far as we could tell. It was awful, but we were so hungry we ate anything. We then had our heads examined, because most people had lice, and out of the 40 intake, only 3 of us were clean. And the remaining 37 had their heads smeared with oil of sassafras, and they were taken off to the dirty hut. And we 3 clean ones were shown into a hut and told to get a bed. It was empty, but for us, blankets, no sheets, a pillowcase. Had barely got to bed, and we were told to get up. It was 6 in the morning. Marched nearly a mile to the mess, given food, issued with kit, and thereafter usual army life, square bashing, inoculations, lectures, gas chambers, all sorts.
Was it men or women who were in charge of
women in charge of training?
Did you think you were treated reasonably or unreasonably?
Well, after home, it was a bit of a shock, but we thought we were treated fairly. Not exactly sympathetically, but we enjoyed it. We didn't mind. We expected life to be tough. The food was rather basic, but there was plenty of it. The worst thing was we expected to have a cold shower every day. And the showers were around the edge of the parade ground. They looked rather like telephone kiosks. And had a sort of canvas shutter, which you pulled down, but it left your feet showing at the bottom. This was so the sergeant outside could make sure you were having a shower. And to have a cold shower behind a canvas screen with the wind blowing down from the Welsh mountains in December was a bit trying. But we quickly learned that you could put your steel helmet underneath the shower and get it thoroughly wet and wet your feet and go out and say, "Sergeant, I've had a shower," and the rest of you was dry.
Did you do that?
Oh, yes, regularly.
In what way did the lack of sympathy come in?
Some of the girls were very homesick, and they were just told, you know, pull yourself together. I think, well, it wasn't really possible. Perhaps somebody could have taught them a little bit. Perhaps they could have been introduced to other girls who are homesick, and they might have felt better. But we all survived, after all.
Was there any weapons training?
No. Gas drill, but that was protective.
Now, coming back to when you were told that you had this special work to do, can you tell me how that developed?
Well, we had intelligence tests, which, as I remember, seemed to be the usual ones that everyone was probably given. You know, you had to write out things and see if you're accurate, and you were given little conundrums like John is Mary's brother, what relation is he to so-and-so, the usual sort of thing that they have in 11 plus nowadays. And then some of us were chosen to go on to further tests, which were a bit more difficult. And then we had rhythm tests and hearing tests. My hearing is very good in those days, it isn't now. And Very, oh, things like echo tests. I can remember going into a room, where did the echo come from? I think that was all. I can't really remember.
Did you at any stage have any inkling as to what was to come?
No, not at all.
And this was Douglas?
No. This was all at Wrexham and at New Brighton holding unit, Belgravia Hotel.
Can you tell me about going to Douglas, please?
Well, we waited in New Brighton until there were about 40 or 50 of us who came from various parts of England for various training camps. And then one morning we were told to pack up and we were going over to the Isle of Man. So we just embarked and went to the Isle of Man. When we got there, I was taken to Hydro Hotel, which was a spa hotel taken over by the army, in an encampment, a barbed wire encampment. And we were then sorted into two squads 45 and 46 we were. And the sorting was done by a male sergeant who took us into a room and said, "I want you to write down these letters as fast as you can." So we were dictated blocks of five letters at great speed, and the faster ones went into squad 45. Slower ones went into squad 46. I was in squad 46.
What happened in Squad 46?
Well, we all had the same training. In fact, there was no difference between any of the squads. We went daily for Morse lessons. We also learned the workings of a radio, which I never fully understood, electricity and magnetism, and the usual. Oh, we had ABCA lectures, Army Bureau of Current Affairs, and the usual amount of drill and so forth. But we went to school every day from 9 till 5 for Morse.
Can you tell me what you remember about the ABCA lectures?
Not really. They were about things that were happening at the time, and we were encouraged to do a little bit of debating. And I also remember we were asked to write an essay. I can't remember why or what, but I can remember swatting over this essay.
But when you say the issues of the time, do you mean the international issues connected with the
International
war?
issues, yes.
Or
And there was some talk then of what was that thing called, mass observation. And we were asked our views on things like mass observation and so forth. And the Peckham experiment, I can't even remember what the Peckham experiment was, but it was a sociological experiment.
how were you expected to have any views on mass observation?
Well, we were expected, I mean, on the whole, we were girls who'd come from secondary schools, a lot came from the civil service, and it was expected of us to have some idea of what had been going on. We did, vaguely.
And the next development?
We trained gradually, getting faster and faster at our Morse, which was the important thing, and doing less and less army drill. And then we moved from our hotels up to Douglas Bay Hotel, where we went operational in practice. That is, we were doing operational work, but we were really only practicing. And we started doing shift work and night work, and actually taking Morse messages from overseas. And we did that for 2 or 3 months, I think. I can't remember.
Whereabouts overseas were the
Oh,
messages
German
from?
messages, always.
From Germany itself.
Germany, yes. All in code. Five-letter blocks again.
Was this German army messages?
Well, we didn't know they were code, you see. I mean, we were German Morse working, Kreisworking, I believe it was called. It was like a spider's web. And another line working, was it? Was explained to us, and then we were given a station to cover, a frequency to cover, and you were expected to take all the messages which came from that. And it was just the same as though we were on operations, but in fact it was just practice. No doubt our work was checked against operational people.
How did you find the German method of transmitting Morse?
Well, I had no experience of any other except our instructors' work in class, so you just accepted it. There was a lot of interference. We learned to call it QRM, which was man-made interference, and QRN, which was thunder or so forth. And you got a lot of interference, and you had to listen through that. Very, very tense, very, very great concentration needed. It was very tiring. We used to come off shift and go to bed automatically. We were so tired. I used to sleep on the cliffs usually.
Did it keep you awake, having had this concentrated
Not
work?
so much then, but later when we got operational, yes, it did.
These were just testing you at this
Really
time.
testing our, because lots of the girls fell by the wayside, and my roommate Elsie Deary was one who was not accepted. Quite a lot of girls didn't measure up to the standard. I don't know what standard we had to reach. I think we were doing something like 20 words a minute Morse at the end. I got up to 32, but some girls could only get up to 14 or so, and then they were inaccurate or couldn't hear or panicked. And they went off and did something else like teleprinting or wireless online or something.
Was there much sense of failure and disappointment on their part at not having got through?
Breaking of friendship, yes. Sort of smugness on those of us who succeeded, and a kind of resignation on the ones who didn't. It was the army who took what came.
Was it just women on the course, or did you have men on it as well?
All women who were learning, but the male instructors took us usually. There was one called Sills, I think it was Harry Sills. We used to give them a hell of a time. We discovered we could make him blush. And we used to do all sorts of things to make him blush. Apple for the teacher, that sort of thing. Ask him awkward questions. We really were rather horrible.
Was he the same age as yourself?
I think he might have been a little older because he'd been overseas. He was probably in his 30s and we were around 18 to 20, you know.
And then what?
We were posted. I think on my group there were about 35 who passed the course. And we were divided into two groups. Some went to Kedleston Hall in Derbyshire and some went to Shenley. I went to Shenley, to Establishment C.
Is that in Essex?
No, that was in Hertfordshire. It's near where Colney Hatch was.
How much can you describe the establishment at Shenley?
It was a country house. I don't know whom it had belonged to. After we left, I believe it was taken over by a Graham Black, was it? The racing driver? Graham someone, anyway. And he lived there. But it was a country house which the army had taken over and adapted. And they had built Nissen huts in the grounds. And a whole field had been devoted to aerials, which stood out like a row of Christmas trees. It was down a very long lane. There were guards at the end with Alsatian dogs. And that's about, oh, there are peacocks in the grounds walking about, a lot of peacocks. In fact, at one point we got hungry, we caught a young peacock and cooked it on our stove in the hut. It was very tough.
Were you underfed?
No, but we were always hungry, we were young. Army rations were sufficient, but you lacked oranges, onions, lemons. In fact, sometimes when we came off duty, we used to lie in our bunks and go around the hut saying what we would eat if we had the chance. People would say roast goose and cream cakes and so on. It was plain food. It was quite good food. There was enough of it, but you missed, well, the extras. We used to go out. There was a transport cafe on the A1, as it then was, at Potter's Bar, I think. And we used to go over there because you could get egg and chips for 1/6. So we used to go and stuff him on egg and chips when we were off duty.
Who was in charge of your work at Shenley?
The CO was a Colonel Ducros, CROS. We had an ATS commandant whose name I can't remember. The ATS officers, on the whole, were welfare officers. We worked under male officers. There was an intelligence corps section, MI5. I met my husband, who was in it there, and the chap in charge of that was Captain Dew, who had been president of the Law Society and I think still was for quite a long while. in charge of our immediate work was a Captain Tansley, who was an HMI, and I believe went afterwards to Bletchley, I'm not sure.
A school inspector, you mean?
Yeah.
What were you expected to do at Shenley?
Well, we worked, at first we worked different shifts. I think the whole idea, the whole course, the whole job was fairly new, and they hadn't settled what shifts we were going to do. They tried four on and four off, but that only lasted 2 or 3 days because you never got any sleep in your four off. By the time you'd got a meal and got to bed, it was time to get up again. And then we tried four on, six off, and that didn't work. And finally, we settled down to four on, eight off, which was comfortable, and you got, I think it was 32 off every 3 days. Once on my 32 off, I slept 18 hours straight off. Then we did find work interfered with your sleeping capacity. It was difficult sometimes to switch off and get to sleep. And the German messages often came over in what were called Teile, a German word for parts. And it was quite commonplace for someone being wakened to go on shift to say, "Can't get up, I'm in the middle of a Teile." You never left a job if you're in the middle of a Teile. And you'd be dreaming in Morse.
How can you dream in Morse?
You can, believe me.
You mean just Morse going through your head all the
Morse
time?
going through your head. You'd be sitting there, you're imagining yourself sitting there with the earphones on and hearing this da-da-da-da-da-da, and you're frantically writing it down, you see.
How long would these Tylers last?
Well, Teiles lasted according to the length of the message. They could be anything from a minute to five. You might get a three-Teiler message. And there'd be one Teiler, then the operator would sign off, and there'd be a break, and then there'd be another Teiler, and so on. I think the word was Teile.
Did you listen to the transmissions of any other nationalities?
We weren't supposed to, but we did. We had very high-powered sets. I had an AKR-88, AR-88, and there was another one, a D something. They were both very powerful, and you could pick up almost anything. And weather reports. I used to listen to weather reports, Reuters news if I got the chance. We weren't supposed to, but we did. But officially, you were given a frequency to watch, and that was your job. Whatever shift you went on that frequency. Mine was two. I can't remember. But at first I was watching a chap called DQB in Berlin. I don't know if he was a German or a Free Frenchman, but he sent purposefully messages at a certain time of night, and it was my job to pick them up. I think he might have been a Free Frenchman. And then I was taken off that, and I was put on Peenemünde, which was the rocket station. I didn't know it was Peenemünde. And there it was certainly a Free Frenchman, and he used to transmit at certain intervals, and I had to be on duty on those times to take his messages. I suppose I was fairly good at it, I don't know, but there were four of us doing it. We covered round the clock, and the four of us covered the station. And I believe we took the earliest messages about the rockets and the rocket installations. And then quite suddenly I was on shift, and the chap was transmitting, and he went in the middle of a message, so the Germans got him. We concluded. I did get a War Office commendation for my work for that.
How frustrating was it for you not really knowing about the material that you were collecting?
You were too busy to think about it. You accepted it was your job to take down blocks, mainly, and occasionally it would filter back. And for instance, I took a message about the sinking of the Scharnhorst, and I don't know whether it was official or not, but I found out, I was told that the message I had taken was about the sinking of the Scharnhorst. And occasionally, if there was a flap on, the German operators used to send in plain language. And although I didn't speak German, you could usually work out what was going on. And after D-Day, after the invasion of Europe, we had a lot of messages in plain language, and that was fascinating.
Can you remember any of them?
Only two, and they weren't important. There was some chap who was sending another message to an operator whose sister was his girlfriend, and he was saying he wouldn't be able to get on leave because of the British advance. And there was a letter, another message from a chap called Wolf, who'd run out of petrol and was panicking, and he was shouting at everyone he wanted petrol.
Did you find the German operators were disciplined?
Yes, but there was one break in their discipline, which was quite surprising. I think it must have been New Year 1944, and it seemed to be almost a party going on because they're all breaking in and sending messages to each other, and it was ending up "Prosit Neue Jahr," and they're all bits of plain language and Morse and all sorts. And my husband-to-be was then working as an intelligence officer, and he told me that most of the messages coming over were the Germans telling each other dirty stories. And they all went through the War Office. But of course, it could have been a form of code.
You said about Peenemünde that you didn't know at the time that it was that, the rocket base. How then do you know that it was now?
I didn't know. I had this War Office commendation, and it was this, that, and the other. All four of us who'd been covering it did, not just me. And tried to find out, and nobody knew. But after I came to Tynemouth, Captain Tansley was down here on holiday, and I asked him, and he said, "Oh, you're covering Peenemünde."
Any other important jobs that you had apart from those?
Not that I know of. We covered Russian Morse after the end of the European War, and I have no idea what I took then.
Was that from Shanley as well?
No, that was when we went to Harrogate.
How did the setup at Harrogate differ from Shanley?
We were billeted in Queen Ethelberga School, which was quite a well-known girls' school, taken over by the army. We were in Nissen huts outside. And the thing I remember most clearly was in the rafters of the Nissen huts there were an enormous number of cockroaches, and they used to fall off on us at intervals. You look horrified. And there is one story which I can't verify, but it was current and everyone gasped about it, that some girl who snored had been sleeping with her mouth open and the cockroach fell in. But certainly there were a lot of cockroaches, and in the morning you always shook out your shoes and your underclothes before you put them on. We worked up in Forest Moor, which was some 12 miles away, near Otley, I fancy. It's still a Royal Naval's intercept station. I've been there since. And we used to go up by truck and to go on shift. It was a much bigger station than Shenley. By that time, it was a new station. By that time, they got the whole operation going. And it was much more organised than Shenley, but not as friendly, not as personal.
How did the Russian transmissions differ from the German ones?
As far as we knew, not at all.
Did they transmit in the same way?
In the same way.
And you also did Japanese work there?
Yes, same way. I imagine Morse is international.
Because people say that different nationalities have a different touch.
Yes, I think they possibly did, but then we were used to all kinds of things. I mean, you get free Frenchmen, you get Englishmen, you get Germans, you've got Italians, you've even got sometimes Egyptians transmitting, so we were used to taking a varied standard of thing.
And the Japanese transmissions were coming from the other side of the world?
I don't know where they're coming from. I never did know. I didn't do Japanese for very long. I think the men did more Japanese than we did. There were men at Harrogate. Men who'd been overseas.
Did the quality of the reception vary according to the time of day?
Yes, it was better at night. It was very, very bad around.